This episode of the CE Podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the Life Insurance Licensing Program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits, live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. Welcome back to the CE Drive podcast. In this episode, we're going to revisit the Registered Disability Savings Plan. We might call this Advanced Concepts in RDSP because we do dip into a couple of slightly unusual characteristics for the RDSP. This episode will be valid for continuing education credits for all life insurance and accident and sickness licenses and jurisdictions. It will be good for Financial Planning Standards Council or FP Canada credits under the financial planning category, and it will also be eligible for advocacy credits. We'll have an IAS number for this course, as we always do. In this episode, we're going to talk to Craig and Ian, both of whom we've spoken to before, and in both cases, these conversations were recorded in the summer of 2019. Both of them came out of very specific calls that I got from Craig and Ian, and you'll hear Ian talk about that a little bit in the interview. They were both in somewhat unconventional scenarios with RDSPs, and in both cases reached out to quite a few people for advice, as I believe is entirely appropriate. I like to try and get well-researched answers, but often there's a heavy element of opinion, and once you get into some of these fancier concepts, it's not uncommon to find somebody who knows a little twist or a loophole. So I do like when people come to me asking for advice. It's somewhat gratifying, but my advice is only mine, and I very much like multiple sources for that kind of thing. Before we get to the interviews, I want to go over some foundational concepts here, some stuff that we want to cover off related to RDSP. Now, you might find it useful to go way back and listen to Season 1, Episode 1, before we dip into this, just because I cover a lot of basic concepts related to the RDSP in that episode. And we cover a little bit more routine RDSP planning questions there. Craig is going to be our first interview, and Craig is going to talk about a scenario where he's looking at an RDSP for an older adult. And I want to cover off some of those planning issues. I think we often consider the RDSP to be really for kids or for parents to fund on behalf of their kids, or maybe grandparents to fund on behalf of the grandkids. But there is a use for the RDSP for older adults. Now, before we see that use, I think it's useful for us to revisit provincial disability supports. These programs vary, obviously, from province to province. So every province has some version of a program in which, if you have a serious disability that prevents you from earning an income, that you will go on to a social assistance or welfare type of benefit. Actually, in most provinces, it is social assistance. So if you're in British Columbia or Manitoba or any of the Atlantic provinces, and you have a serious disability where you can't work or can't work very much, typically if you earn a maximum somewhere between $20,000 and $35,000 a year, depending on the number of kids you have, then you can qualify for some social assistance. And that social assistance is not much money, depends on the province, between about $400 and $700 per month. That's not intended to be generous, and it's not. Now, for people on social assistance, they often have a second layer of benefits. They often get a housing allowance. They might get an additional supplement based on the number of kids they have. And they do get access typically to discounted drug plans or possibly directly funded by the province. They'll have their health care, dental, and drug plans. So there's other benefits there, but the actual income amount is not that great. In fact, many of my financial planning clients, I've spoken about this before, typically are in a fairly financially exposed position, and many of them are on Alberta Works. And it's pretty typical that I see people living on between about $700 and about $1,900 a month in total from Alberta Works. So not a lot of money. And that $1,900 is for people with a couple of kids typically. So not hugely beneficial financially. And I know that there's this whole mythology around people not working so that they can collect welfare. And I don't know. Certainly I don't see any of that with my clients. I think any of them would happily work if they had the capacity to do so. Now in Alberta, Ontario, and Saskatchewan, we actually don't use the straight-up welfare programs in those three provinces. Ontario has ODSP, the Ontario Disability Supports Plan, and Saskatchewan has SED, Saskatchewan Assured Income for the Disabled. Alberta has Assured Income for the Severely Handicapped. Those three programs are all a little bit more generous than what you would get if you were just on straight-up social assistance. They also all have a little bit of additional restrictions and additional supports with them. So the dollar amounts that you'll see in those programs, if you're looking at ODSP, for example, and there are some proposed changes to ODSP, I'll talk about that in a moment. But if you are looking at ODSP, you've got somebody with no dependents, that person would qualify for about $700 a month. If you've got somebody with two dependents, that person qualifies for about $1,700 a month. In Alberta, if you've got somebody on AISH with no dependents, that person can qualify for up to $1,700 a month. The AISH amounts just got bumped up. Once you add dependents, that's another $200 for the first kid, another $100 per child beyond that. And then there's a bunch of housing supports and, again, health care and medical and dental and so forth. The point with all of those programs that's important to understand before we dip into the RDSP is they all have asset tests and income tests, and pretty harsh. So ODSP, for example, if you make more than $200 a month, and there's a little bit of finer points to this, there's some exempted income, but for the most part, pretty much every kind of dollar you can earn would have a test applied against your ODSP benefit. And when you make more than $200 in Ontario, the rate of clawback for those benefits is 50 cents on the dollar. Alberta's quite a bit higher. Alberta, you can make $800 before you start to hit that 50 cent clawback. So in Alberta, you can actually, as a single person, make about $32,000 and still have at least a tiny bit of AISH benefit. Now, as far as assets go, we have a problem here. So Alberta's, again, the most generous province with its asset test against AISH. Alberta allows you to accumulate up to $100,000 of assets, plus a car and a home. And there's, at least on paper, no upper limit to the value of that home. Maybe if you owned a $9 or $10 million house, that might get your caseworker to discontinue your benefits. But if you own a home of sort of modest value in Edmonton or Calgary, that's an asset that's in the close to $1 million range, certainly in Calgary, $700,000 or $800,000 for a modest home in that city, or maybe upper modest, but you get the idea. That kind of thing would be perfectly permissible under AISH plus your $100,000 of benefits. There is actually an exemption for pension assets, real pension assets, but wouldn't be that common to run into a seriously disabled person or a person with serious disabilities who is in that position. Other provinces, though, are far more restrictive. So Ontario, for example, that limit is $40,000 for a single person or $50,000 for a couple. Oh yeah, just going back to Ontario. So Ontario is actually probably in the near future going to change its income test for ODSP so that you'll be able to earn $300 a month up from $200. But once you get to that $301st dollar, you'll have a 75 cent clawback per dollar of income. Very harsh clawback then. Basically means you're working for very little money if you're that person with a disability who's only able to get a sort of minimum wage, few hours a month type of job. It becomes very difficult to kind of claw your way out of that situation. So I think you can tell my bent there. I would prefer that it's easy for people to work their way out of an impoverished situation, and I don't think that those circumstances are there with that proposed change. So going back to the asset tests, with the asset tests, you're looking at somewhere between $5,000 and $100,000 of assets. Now, what is allowed in most jurisdictions, New Brunswick is actually a little bit shaky on this. New Brunswick is kind of weird. Newfoundland has no allowance at all for the Henson Trust. But you'll hear Craig talk about the Henson Trust and how it's recently been introduced in Alberta. Basically, a Henson Trust is an absolute discretionary trust. And what that absolute discretion means is that the trustee is under no obligations to pay any amounts to the beneficiary or beneficiaries in any given year. With that set of circumstances in place, the rules for the vast majority of disability supports programs say, look, if it's absolute discretionary, we don't consider that to be an asset of the person with the disability because they have no right to that money. It is worth setting up that trust through a qualified lawyer with an estate planning specialty. That's really your best bet, especially because the rules here are particular to each province, and you want to make sure that you are jumping through the right hoops in that regard. So the Henson Trust, in theory, you could have hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars of assets held in that Henson Trust. You still have to watch that income that comes out of the trust would count against your income test. Again, that rule will vary a little bit from province to province, but that is fundamentally true. And it's not taxable income, so don't get this confused with taxable income. Those types of programs generally consider all manner of income. So you might have TFSA assets from which you're drawing, for example, or you might have your Henson Trust, which is paying you maybe some non-taxable amounts. Those are generally still going to have to be reported and count against whatever income test your province has in place. Now, the reason that that all is so important for an older adult is that we often have folks who are in their late 40s or early 50s, right up until maybe their early 60s, who are counting on their provincial disability supports, and maybe they have a parent who dies and leaves them an inheritance, for example. And the question now becomes, how can we manage that inheritance and not lose those very important provincial disability supports? The Henson Trust is one way to manage that. And now with the Henson Trust here in Alberta, and at least to some extent in all provinces except Newfoundland, we have a fairly good opportunity to shelter some of those assets, really put them aside, maybe drip some out periodically for whatever needs arise, but staying within that income test. Now, the other choice here is potentially to use the Registered Disability Savings Plan. As Craig rightly mentions, the Registered Disability Savings Plan gets its bonds and grants only if the beneficiary is under the age of 50. Once the beneficiary has hit their 50th birthday, there is no more opportunity to get bonds and grants. You can't get them in arrears. You can't get them on a buyback basis, whatever. Once you have that 50th birthday, there is no accessing bonds and grants. But it might still be practical to put money into the RDSP at that point. It might be if you're dealing with a relatively small asset amount, something less than $200,000, it might be easier to use the RDSP than to use the Henson Trust, for example. And using the RDSP, you can also get the benefit of an RRSP or RIF rollover from a deceased parent's RSP or RIF, probably a RIF in that case, but that would allow you to have that set of assets and be able to continue collecting your social assistance or your disability income benefits, usually until age 65. Usually those benefits cut off at age 65. So you could have your social assistance until 65 and then move on to use whatever assets you were left in that inheritance after age 65. Okay, let's hear from Craig. Let's hear what Craig has to say about some client scenarios where he's dealt with the RDSP. The color for today's episode is purple. The color is purple. Thanks very much for joining us today, Craig.
Oh, my pleasure.
Craig is a financial planner based in St. Albert. He is both insurance and mutual funds licensed, primarily does a financial planning practice.
Yep.
Craig and I have communicated about a couple of client scenarios recently. An area that's been a big focus for you lately has been the registered disability savings plan. Seems like you've run into a fair number of clients who have disabled children in the family.
Yeah, in the last 6 to 8 months or so, it's becoming more and more common in my dealings with various families.
Now, do you think this happens because it's one of these things where once you become a little bit aware of it, that you just start to ask better questions? Or is it that there's some referral network that you've somehow tied into, maybe inadvertently? Do you know what the impetus is for this?
I would say that a lot of it has to do with the referral network, frankly. I think there's a lot of people out there that know of families in situations where they need some sort of planning related to children with some sort of physical or mental or cognitive, I should say, disability. And there's not a lot of advice, I think, out there. So when somebody's familiar with it or finds somebody that's available to help assist those families, that's where I'm getting some of these referrals.
Do you find that people generally are relying entirely on informal networks for their support at this time, or do you find that people do sometimes have formal networks and they're able to use some resources that might be accessed through a charity or through government or whatever the case?
Yes, I think it's a pretty tight network, I would argue, in that people seek a lot of support and advice from different groups like LOSICA and whatnot. But then it's being able to sit down with somebody, provide more of a clear path as to what a disability plan might look like and how that might prepare their child for their own retirement if they are unable to have an independent lifestyle. So that's where some of these meetings are very positive. And once you can lay down a path and show people that these are the types of savings you can accumulate for your children, you know, in a 15, 20, 30 year timeframe.
I definitely think that people are always going to be emotional when they're talking about their children. In this case, I think sometimes those emotions can be exacerbated. Do you find that there are tools you use to help people look at this in a less emotional way, or is it beneficial sometimes to harness the emotions that people will naturally feel here?
I guess in the dealings that I've had, it's been very straightforward. Not a lot of emotion has come across the table. We're dealing with it in a matter of a fact manner. Looking at the realities of the circumstance, I think that sometimes just kind of helps with clarity. And obviously being sincere to people's circumstance, I'm not saying that that's not part of the process, but it's sometimes gratifying from the parents and whatnot that I'm speaking to when we can kind of say, this is the plan that we're going to put in place. And, you know, I think it removes some of the uncertainty and gives them a positive feeling, at least from setting up that type of direction, I guess.
Have you dealt with scenarios where there might be an impaired life expectancy for the disabled child?
Yes, actually, you know, now that becomes a little bit more of an emotional conversation. That would be one that has occurred because it's hard to deal with long-term planning when life expectancy is into the 50, 55, something to that effect. So then a lot of this accumulation of, you know, on the RDSP side and then trying to just follow the standard practice of making those withdrawals before their 60th birthday, et cetera. And obviously the repayment provisions and all of these things that come into effect, it does become a little bit more difficult to plan because you don't have some of those handrail to follow with different timeframes. And actually in that particular scenario, we elected to go with a tax-free savings account plan strategy rather than the RDSP because we didn't want to have to deal with contributing into a plan that had such, you know, serious clawbacks or repayment provisions on the grants and bonds that you would receive.
Right. There is a way to deal with shortened life expectancy in the RDSP. I'll cover that outside of this conversation afterwards, but I find it is very restrictive. And I think your decision to use TFSA there is probably still the best decision. I find the RDSP, you talk about restrictions on it, that can be exceptionally challenging. How do you talk to the people who might be investing in an RDSP about those restrictions, Greg?
Well, I try to outline them. The formula is obviously very complicated when you start looking at the lifetime disability withdrawals. So we try to speak in a manner or planning that ensures that we have that 10-year time frame so that we're not going to have those clawbacks where it's applicable, right? In regards to, you know, shortened life expectancy, and that in some cases a situation where it's known, it's just when you look at statistics is kind of what we're looking at. So it's not where they're already in a situation where a physician has, you know, said that there's a time frame on their life expectancy. I haven't dealt with anything like that specifically, but just trying to help people understand when you're putting funds into these programs that there is basically are restrictions or provisions that prevent you from recycling your grants for a, you know, a 10-year time frame.
Are the situations you're dealing with, Craig, exclusively with minor children, or do you have some situations where you have parents with children in their late teens or early 20s?
Yes. So I've helped a couple of families, and actually the transition has been beneficial to help them understand how the grants that they'd be eligible for would then transition to their child's income at age of majority or age of maturity. So that's been helpful, or they've seen that as helpful in understanding how they can build that plan. I have also had a conversation with an adult child into that 49, 50 years of age. In dealing with that, she was hoping that there'd be an opportunity to capitalize on some carry forward, I guess, provisions on the grants. And unfortunately, when we started looking at her birth date, the contribution schedule prevented her from being able to take advantage of that. And then we ended up again looking at some other strategy regarding a tax-free savings account.
It is nice to have that TFSA as the fallback. And I do recall the very specific wording on the rules around this transition from age 49 to 50. And what you would normally think of being able to buy back those earlier years, of course, is not available, as you and I now well know. The other thing I was wondering about with the adult or the transition into adulthood, do you have any conversations around that loss of capacity and how that can impact the estate plan, or having somebody who never had legal capacity and how that can impact the estate plan?
I guess in a general sense, looking at somebody's total financial circumstance, obviously we want to make sure that we're filling all the gaps. And the estate planning consideration will make mention of, do you have a will? Do you have powers of attorney? These types of things. And in the cases I've dealt with regarding RDSP specifically, everybody has already taken steps to manage that. And I think that's a reflection of the cases I've been dealing with where the disability was typically at birth. So they've had a number of years to plan and gather professional advice regarding that. So me touching on it is helpful to them to know that they've got appropriate planning already in place.
It is good to know that you've looked after to feel a little bit of sense of responsibility around the steps that you've taken. Do you do any work with our ESPs? Have you set up our ESPs for or recommended that RDSPs be set up for any of these scenarios?
Not in the circumstances that I've been dealing with. We focus primarily on the RDSPs in the cases that I've dealt with simply because it doesn't look like post-secondary is an option. So rather we've focused on contributing and maximizing the grants through the RDSPs.
Now, I know you come originally into this business from an asset management perspective. That's fair, Craig?
Yeah.
What do you do as far as asset allocation with these RDSPs? You know, you have a parent investing for their 5-year-old child or 10-year-old child, 40, 50, 60-year time horizon. How do you have the asset allocation discussion, and what would you like to see in terms of a good asset allocation for an RDSP?
Well, when we have the opportunity to look at long-term planning where some of these issues like life expectancy and whatnot don't need to be taken into consideration as much, I guess, in terms of the plan. We're obviously looking at growth, in my opinion, and it is going to be a fallback onto what the family is obviously comfortable with. I don't want to simply place my bias or perspective onto them and say that this is what you should do. I try to, like I say, take an understanding of their risk tolerance, but also look at the fact that you have the opportunity for long-term growth within these funds. There's kind of two sides of it, is that in the fact that you're getting these grants, you know, these 3x grants allows you to either take on more risk because you are having significant government contributions, or to be fairly conservative because you're getting government contributions, right? So you're getting the growth through your grants rather than through your rate of return. So a lot of the time it falls onto what the family is comfortable with. But at the same time, there's a lot of managed products out there that fall into the, or managed pools into the balance fund or a growth fund or something to that effect. And we'll try to skew the allocation based on their risk tolerance, whether it be a 75-25 in terms of equities to fixed income or 60-40, and kind of have those conversations to see what they're most comfortable with.
When you talk about managed pools, so you're able to use managed pools in the RDSP context. I don't want to get too specific there necessarily, but can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there's a couple of companies, I guess, that we have the option to work with that can have some sort of managed solution that's RDSP eligible. From a management perspective, it's a nice solution to have for a family that's looking for, like I said, long-term growth. We can kind of slide down the scale and just adjust the equity allocation to what they're comfortable with.
That does seem like a pretty elegant solution. Do you have any last minute thoughts around or any words of advice for folks out there who may be just getting started or have maybe that first client who has a need where the RDSP might be appropriate? Craig, anything else to share?
Well, I guess just recently with some of the changes to Alberta with regards to Henson Trusts, that's another strategy, I guess, to look at when doing long-term planning for families with a disability. So I guess familiar yourself with the literature that's out there. You know, it's only been a short amount of time, but one of the big things is the legislation's changed. So families that may have applied for AISH or had their AISH terminated because of some sort of inheritance or something prior to April, revisit the application process because under the new guidelines, you'd be able to now qualify for AISH and have this trust set up to provide, your disabled child with additional resources going forward.
That's great that you're on top of the Henson Trust changes in Alberta. Alberta and Newfoundland, of course, have traditionally been the provinces where Henson Trusts have not been permitted. And like you say, Alberta has changed that in 2018. Can I ask, Craig, how you stay on top of that kind of news? How did you become aware that the Henson Trust was going to be permitted in Alberta? Was this through those sort of disability networks or just reading the news, or how do you come across that kind of thing?
I have a personal connection, I guess, to stay on top of it. And I do follow a number of different, literature sources through Twitter and whatnot, where I'm continually reading headlines every morning and every night, I guess, to stay on top of it. And then just through the conversations I'm having with these families, it's something that's been top of mind. It's, even in over the last number of years, it's been like, when is Alberta going to kind of join the rest of Canada? And so it's been something that I've been interested in following from that respect. And then when you're sitting down with these families, it's something to take into consideration, because a lot of the time, if you're looking at insurance options and that type of thing for some legacy planning or for some estate planning, you don't want your income to be offset by an inheritance. And under these new rules, it's obviously favorable for these families that they can do that type of planning. It's just been something I've been interested in, I guess, and with some of the announcements that have been happening over the last year and then seeing it come together here in the last couple of months, it's beneficial from a planning standpoint.
I am heartened by the number of advisors I run into who are aware of the Henson Trust changes. People are at least paying attention to that. So that's good. Kudos to the folks that stay on top of their industry news, Craig. That's good. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks very much for sharing with us some of your experiences around the Registered Disability Savings Plan and planning in general for folks with disabilities. That's great stuff, Craig. I think a lot of people will get value out of your experiences there and the stuff you're able to share with those clients.
You'll be able to get your continuing education credits by going to bccquiz.online. That's BCC as in Business Career College, bccquiz.online. And there's a little quiz you'll do there, just a few questions. And if you're already a subscriber, then it will issue you a certificate. If you're not already a subscriber, then you will have to sign up, and you'll be able to sign up there, and you'll be able to get your continuing education credits that way.
This episode of the CE Podcast is brought to you by Business Career College. Business Career College is a leading provider of financial services education, including the Life Insurance Licensing Program, the entire set of courses leading to the CFP certification, which is actually where I spend most of my time teaching and where I have met many of the participants in these podcasts. We also provide continuing education credits,
live classroom and webinar instruction in support of the Elder Planning Counselor designation, and a few other odds and ends in support of folks in the financial services industry. You can find the full catalog of course offerings at www.businesscareercollege.com. In that interview, we heard Craig talk about not just using the RDSP, but he talked a little bit about his community involvement here. And I know Craig reasonably well. He's actually very well known in his local community, both in the nonprofit sector, and he does some fundraising for folks with disabilities. And he specifically mentions LOSICA in there. LOSICA is a St. Albert-based organization that supports adults with developmental disabilities. And you'll hear in the next interview Ian talk as well about having some direct involvement with nonprofits that specifically help kids where they're in a tough situation. So I think most of the financial advisors I run into do take lots of opportunities or do get into lots of these nonprofit opportunities. I don't think that it necessarily has to be, there has to be a business motive for doing that, but often the folks in this industry are well suited for that. It just happens that both Craig and Ian have gotten some benefit out of this. I would encourage you, if you're not doing this, to reach out, go find those nonprofit opportunities, whether it's minor sports or, as we hear in these cases, people with disabilities, or whatever it happens to be. Find something near and dear to your heart. It can, doesn't have to, it can result in business opportunities, but I think it has to be something you will enjoy first and foremost. Now, in Ian's interview, he's going to talk about the specified disability savings plan, and you'll hear us kind of dance around the rules a little bit here. The rules for the specified disability savings plan are that it has to be somebody who is likely to die within 5 years. We need a diagnosis from an MD or from a nurse practitioner indicating that death is likely within 5 years. And once you set up the SDSP, then it allows you to take up to $10,000 a year out of the plan without triggering any sort of repayment of the assistance holdback amount. You may recall that assistance holdback amount from episode one. That's the bonds and grants received in the prior 10 years. And of course, normally what happens is if you take funds out of the RDSP while the assistance holdback amount is still in effect, you really lose those bonds and grants. So that $10,000 limit is fairly generous. Well, potentially generous, depends how much is in the plan. It actually could be more than $10,000 as well. It could be up to your lifetime disability assistance payment amount, which I'll talk about a little bit after we hear from Ian. So let's see what Ian has to say. Okay, thanks very much for joining us today, Ian. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. Ian is a financial planner based in Kingsville, Ontario, and we're going to see some of this lifelong learning, but Ian is clearly a lifelong learner. He's both life and property and casualty licensed. He carries his investment funds license. He also has completed the CIM designation, which is the top end of investment management. So, you know, congratulations, Ian, on continuing to pursue, and I know those aren't the only things you do. I know you do a lot of other learning, but congratulations on continuing to further your education.
Yeah, my education junkie addiction.
It's good. Hey, it helps pay my bills, Ian, right?
Yeah.
So before the call here, Ian and I were chatting a little bit about a client, and it's actually a client that Ian and I talked about some time ago, a client where there's a little bit of an unconventional use of a registered disability savings plan. Can you give a little background about this particular scenario, Ian?
Yeah, absolutely. So younger couple, I think they were in their late 20s or very early 30s, had come in. They were investing in a RESP for their son. Their son is, I believe, right around 1 year old right now. And I can't remember the specific disability that he has, but unfortunately, their son will never end up with the cognitive ability beyond maybe a 5 to 6 month old. And in terms of life expectancy with this certain diagnosis, I think the latest they can ever make it up to is about 15 to 20 years old. when they originally come in, they were chatting about, you know, just wanting to save for him and put into RESP just because of the grant money and things like that. And usually when I sit down with a client, my first goal is making sure their incomes are protected. So looking at disability insurance and life insurance. And then we kind of grow off there. But one of the next points I usually talk about is critical illness insurance specifically for the kid. And it's because I work with a group called the Neighborhood Charitable Alliance here in my town. And we just raise money to help out local people here in the community that fall on hard times. And most of the time, we don't have a hospital directly in Kingsville. So our next major hospital is Windsor, and beyond that, it's London. And London's about an hour and a half to 2 hour drive. And if your kid's really sick, that's where they end up going. So we end up giving a lot of money to families who end up having a child who's sick and they have to live up in London for a while. So there's sometimes accommodations if they can't get into Ronald McDonald House. There's gas costs. There's just the time that they're off work. So I always touch on that with a critical illness insurance because you can't get a disability insurance policy for a kid because they're not earning income. Now, in this case, we obviously couldn't set up a critical illness insurance policy. So what I had proposed to them was instead of putting the money into the RESP and getting the grant money, which is fairly minimal, why don't we put the money into the RDSP policy? And normally when you're putting money into an RDSP and then you're looking to get the money out, there's a fairly long wait time. But if you can prove, and you have to actually sign off documents with a doctor, you can actually have an early withdrawal. So as soon as their child starts failing, you could pull that money out without incurring any kind of clawback on those disability credits. So what it was doing was it was helping fund the time that they're going to need to take off. Inevitably, their kid's going to end up in the hospital for an extended period of time, and they can actually spend the time with them. But just a different way of kind of creating that critical illness insurance policy for them.
Just to clarify here, Ian, so the requirement here is that the paperwork that you would submit to, I believe it's ESDC in this case, would indicate that the child has an impaired life expectancy. I believe it's that they're expected to die within 5 years. I can't remember the particulars here.
Correct. Yeah, and actually you cannot fill out that paperwork prior. You have to hit a point in time because as soon as you trigger that, you can't put money into the RDSP anymore. So we have to let this thing accumulate. And then as soon as the kid gets into a worse scenario, or we know inevitably this kid's going to spend the rest of its life in the hospital, that's when you would actually trigger that pull.
And at that point, the plan becomes, I believe it's called a specified disability savings plan, and it does allow
it
access without repayment of grants and bonds. There is the challenge. So if the child dies too quickly, and not to put too fine a point on
correct.
It, then you go back to the normal treatment at death. Is that correct?
No, you do. So you're not able to, you don't have access to that grant money. So the regular rules apply for the RDSP that of death of a beneficiary prior to, I believe it's age 50.
Yeah, that's right. And based on grants and bonds that have gone in the last 10 years in that case. So,
correct.
Yeah. So I can see how this becomes a little bit of a timing issue. This is a very difficult scenario.
So we laid out, we just did a pro and con list with the client, the pros of the RDSP and the fact that, hey, there is potential that you are going to have a lot more money built into this thing, which then later on down the road, you're actually going to be able to take time off work because the grant money is phenomenal inside these RDSPs. On the other side of things was the fact that, hey, if we don't pull this or he dies unexpectedly without us having time to get the paperwork in, you could lose the money. But on the flip side, putting the money into an RESP wasn't going to be all that beneficial either.
No, in either case, if events don't work out right, you would get back your principal and not much else.
Exactly. And they're not sure if they were going to have a second child. They don't have a second child right now. But the only way they could, that it would work on the RESP side is if they already had the second child prior to the death of their first child, and then we can at least roll the RESP credits over. But at the end of the day, you get to double up on those RESP credits, right? You only get up to the lifetime max of, what is it, the $7,200 of grant money. So the way we looked at it is if we are able to do the RDSP, we get the grant money, the RDSP, we pull the trigger, the paperwork at the correct time, they could use some of that money to kind of offset their income, but then they could take the rest of the money and contribute it currently to an RESP or wait till their second child comes around and contribute to the RESP. And it's almost like the older brother who's since passed away is almost gifting his unknown brother this money.
Right. I mean, it's a tragic situation and it really is the best of a tragic situation.
Yeah.
Now, Ian, you had mentioned as well, you don't have the RDSP on your product shelf. So you work at a firm where there is a, let's say, a constrained product shelf. I'm wondering then what you told the family as far as how to go set up the RDSP, how involved were you after the fact then, given that you couldn't handle everything yourself in-house here?
Yeah, so it was interesting. I had reached out to a number of RDSP kind of specialists across Canada just to verify all my information. Also talking with the government website, also having a number of conversations with you on the phone, Jason, which was fantastic. From there, we had two people locally that we knew of, and they had a prior existing bank relationship where their RESP was. At the end of the day, we opted to just use their pre-existing relationship. I actually went to the meeting with them, got approval from their advisor to sit in on the meeting because he wasn't sure how this would actually work. So I was able to lay out the paperwork for him just to show that this is how it was going to work and everything else. And just to kind of give him some comfort because he hadn't done a whole lot of RDSPs, but he had the availability to do them. So, and it was comfortable for them because it was their existing bank relationship and things like that.
Now, my understanding here, Ian, is that this is not a terribly well-off couple. I think you mentioned previously that they were going to qualify for the higher level of grants. So we know household income.
Yeah.
Somewhere less than 90,000. How do you justify that in your practice? You know, you have a business to run here, and I know you put a lot of effort into this. Do you see this as a sort of pro bono effort, or what's the hard to run a business with this kind of thing as your regular practice? I don't know if you can comment on that.
Yeah, we received no money from the referral over to the bank or anything like that. But at the end of the day, I mean, I'm very fortunate that my practice also has property and casualty insurance. So the bulk majority of my income is derived from the property and casualty side of things. So this is just a bit more of a pro bono case. And I really, really enjoyed it. And I said to my wife after, I said, if I could do those cases all day long without getting paid, I said, I would be just living the life. It was a lot of fun to work on. It was more complex. It involved me speaking to a lot of really great advisors across Canada. The RDSP is so new, and it's not like there's a whole bunch of different RDSP products across the world that you can do any kind of comparisons with. And because it's so new, a scenario such as this where you're trying to pull the money early because you know that the child's not going to have a long life expectancy, it made it very, very difficult. But like I said, it was a lot of fun just because of the difficulty of it. So in terms of how do I justify it, you feel good. They're a great couple. I still see them around town and chit-chat. Actually, they dropped off a bottle of wine around Christmas just to say thank you for all the help, and definitely not needed, but greatly appreciated.
It's a great story, Ian, and I know it's a hard balance to strike. I really respect that commitment to helping out this client, even though there's not a direct financial benefit for you, but that benefit to your soul, that's hard to ignore, right? I know, speaking from my own experience, the only financial planning I do now, I do a little bit for some financial advisors here and there, but the only sort of structured financial planning I do is in the pro bono market. I'm in a little different situation than you. I'm not counting on that as any part of my paying the bills. And I love it. I find it's very rewarding work and often frustrating, but when it's great, it's absolutely great. So I would encourage other folks out there to not turn away an opportunity just because it's not going to pay, understanding that you still have to feed your family and pay your mortgage and all that kind of stuff. But I think that taking on some cases like this can be a great learning experience and can bring home other benefits that you may not think about. So yeah, that's great, Ian. Thanks very much for sharing that story. Is there any, do you have any last minute thoughts about the RDSP or about these clients that people might find useful?
No, I don't think so. I think that we as advisors all need to just think a little bit outside of the box because we're in such an analytical world that we kind of center ourselves in. And I mean, a lot of what we do is, you know, TFSAs and RESPs and, you know, investments, life insurance and disability. I think we're some of the most fun that we have in our kind of debriefing on client conversations is where we actually look outside of the box from what the normal would be.
Agreed. Yeah, exploring a little bit, thinking about what other opportunities are out there. If you're not doing that, then I think it robs you of some fun and some learning opportunities. So thanks very much for sharing that, Ian. I really appreciate it and have a wonderful day.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, those that know me will know that I like those kind of unconventional approaches. Fairly tragic situation that Ian talks about there with a child who looks to have a very short life expectancy, but in a case like that, I think it's good that Ian goes to bat for those clients and really tries to find them something that's going to help their tough financial situation it can be difficult. What I find generally with people like that, when they're in that type of situation, they will be obviously emotionally devastated throughout. But once they get past that, they will often have a way to kind of look at things on a very matter-of-fact basis. So that's a case of really knowing your client. I sure wouldn't want to have this conversation with the client in the early days after they find out that their child is terminally ill. But as you get to know the client, you'll get a feel for when it's appropriate to talk about maybe other deeper financial concepts. And I think it's important to recognize that there is a sort of appropriate bedside manner around these types of issues. And I can be a little bit, I think, cold or detached from these things. I hope in real life I'm a little bit more sensitive to these issues, but sometimes in class we really talk about these things in a very kind of maybe mercenary way. Now, I mentioned before we heard from Ian that when you set up the specified disability savings plan, that you're allowed to take up to $10,000 a year or your lifetime disability assistance payment maximum. So what the LDAP, or the lifetime disability assistance payment, is, that's what's supposed to happen with the RDSP. When somebody lives long enough, they get to age 60, and at age 60, they will start what is essentially a RIF type of withdrawal schedule, where they're going to now have a required withdrawal every year from their RDSP. And by age 60, you'll have gone 10 years without having had any new money go into the plan. There's no concerns around any assistance holdback amount or anything like that. So that'll have gone 10 years. The formula here is a little bit like the RIF formula. The LDAP formula, you take your fair market value of assets as of January 1st, again, similar to the RIF formula, divided by 80, or your age, whichever is greater. So kind of like the early RIF formula here, plus 3 minus your age. So I have a little example here. If you had, let's say, $300,000 in your RDSP at age 60, so you turn 60 in November, and then on January 1st of the following year, you are 60 and you have $300,000 in your RDSP at that point. You'll be required to take out just over $13,000. That would be based on $300,000, the amount in the RDSP, divided by 80, which is the greater between your age and 80, because you're 60, so 80 is more than 60. So you take 80 plus 3, so that's 83 minus 60. So 300,000 divided by 23, it's about a $13,000 withdrawal. So it's actually very similar to your RIF. If you were 60 and you had a RIF, your minimum withdrawal there would be 3.33%. Here, your minimum withdrawal is about 4.33%. So it's a little bit larger, and that's intentional. It's supposed to accommodate a shorter life expectancy, which, of course, is not always true for somebody with a disability, but often will be the case. Now, as I mentioned, we recorded all of this content in the summer of 2018. But as it happens, I'm recording this chunk on the 21st of March of 2019. And some of you will know that 2 days ago now, we had the new federal budget come out. And there are actually two items that concern the RDSP in the new federal budget. And I don't know if somebody's listening to me. I know I'm not the only one voicing this concern, but some of you who listened to season 1, episode 1, heard me complain about the fact that if you have an RDSP and your beneficiary no longer qualifies for the disability tax credit, that you have a real problem where now you have to unwind the RDSP, or you can apply to have a delay if you have a physician or a nurse practitioner or some other medical professionals, depending on the disability tax credit. But if you have the appropriate medical professional who says, yes, you're likely to be disabled again, that you actually could have held that RDSP in place for a period of up to 4 years. Under budget 2019, what's going to happen, assuming this all receives royal assent and whatever else, passes as it looks like it would, that 4-year window will go away. So that now, if you have somebody who had a registered disability savings plan because they had the disability tax credit, and now they lose access to the disability tax credit. There's actually no requirement, and there probably never will be a requirement now, for that person to collapse their RDSP. The way this works is if that person actually waits all the way until 60, until they would take out their LDAP amount, they probably get to use all of their grants and bonds. So that's actually pretty good. You know, I've often been very critical of the RDSP and said people were setting it up prematurely or whatever the case is when they didn't know the rules around collapsing it. But with this new set of rules, you really open the door to a far better treatment, and this takes away my primary concern about the RDSP. I still think it's endlessly complicated, and now it just got a little bit more complicated, but that does, I think, give us a reason with younger kids where I've had some hesitation about setting up the RDSP to look at putting that RDSP in place when you have that disability tax credit available, unlike my traditional advice here, which has been to wait until the disability tax credit shows up at least a couple of times as an adult. So you can really dispense with that old criticism I had. I'm so happy about that. Although it does mean I have to rewrite a bunch of textbook material, which is a good thing. The other change that got made, and this one kind of snuck in, I had to dig into the budget documents to find this one. The federal government is going to add RDSP protection to the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act. I'm not sure how that's going to carry across provinces. Some provinces already have bankruptcy protection for the RDSP in their various court seizures acts. So if your province doesn't have it already, you're likely to see creditor protection or bankruptcy protection for RDSP assets in the fairly near future. The number for today's episode is 4. The number is 4. I did want to just comment a little bit on our delayed release schedule. We continue to fight with getting episodes out on time. I do apologize for that. There's always something, it seems, that causes some delay somewhere along the way. We're working on it, and I still have enough content to get us the number of episodes that I had always intended by the end of June. So check us out in about 2 weeks. See how this plays out. About 2 weeks from now, we'll hear from Sham and Chris. And we're going to dig into some, I think, fairly pure financial planning scenarios here. I really look forward to that episode. It lets me cover quite a few topics. I do want to take a second as well to thank those folks that have gone over to iTunes and left us a rating. A couple reviews now, 5 ratings, all 5-star ratings. I expect that'll drop at some point, but that's good. I'd like to get a few more ratings and reviews in there. If you wouldn't mind, pop over to iTunes and rate or review. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed and learned something from the episode. A bunch of people have a hand in producing this podcast. Joseph Tong takes care of our music and editing. Anthony Summers is responsible for tech support. Maria Nguyen takes care of all the CE applications to the various accrediting bodies. Marjorie Lewis takes care of certificates when the machine doesn't do it. Desiree Gretton Hicks and Penny Watt take care of our marketing, making sure that there are folks out there to listen to the podcast. Thanks to all those who help out.